I think he looks toward President Xi in China, Kim Jong-un in North Korea, even Maduro. You know, if you listen to how President Trump talks about these leaders, he's heaped huge amounts of praise on the former Al-Qaeda leader who's now the president of Syria. You know, he talks about him with great admiration as well. He likes this kind of toughness, this like ruling by iron fist. And I think talk about, you know, NATO and EU democracy is just very unimpressive to Trump and therefore to his movement. And all of that has combined to drive a wedge between the U.S. and Europe that wasn't previously there.
So I want to begin with U.S. foreign policy, which is obviously a topic that you've devoted a lot of attention to. And we're speaking a couple of days after the U.S. Launched its second major attack on Iran under Trump's second presidency. So, I mean, you've long criticized Western leaders who stress the importance of a rules-based international order. You've argued that this has always been a self-serving fraud. But I want to put to you that, you know, Trump's open rejection of that order seems to have enabled an even more unrestrained and dangerous U.S. foreign policy. Does that seem right to you?
Maybe if I were being as kind of generous and agreeable as I possibly could be, I would say maybe mildly more so. But actually, I think one of the big differences that I've had with a lot of people who have been very critical of Trump on the Western, on the left, in the West, and elsewhere, is I do actually see Trump much more as a continuation of what came before him rather than some radical deviation from it. And that's true as well with wars of aggression, with invasions. You know, obviously but one of the things that really formed my political worldview, especially as I began doing journalism, was the invasion of Iraq and all of the abuses and horrors that came not with just with that, but with the war on terror. And you have Guantanamo and a worldwide torture regime and kidnapping and rendition and black sites of the CIA, to say nothing of the crimes all throughout the Cold War and into Vietnam. So it is difficult for me to say, oh, I think there's something fundamentally different and worse about Trump's foreign policy. I think maybe one thing you could say about it is he's actually just more candid. It's more honest. It doesn't really bother as much with a lot of the moralistic disguise that prior presidents or Western leaders used. I'm not sure I would agree, though, that it's by category worse or more aggressive.
Okay. I mean, can we just pause on that for a second? I mean, in just over a year, so Trump's attacked Venezuela, abducted his president, illegally bombed boats in the Caribbean, carried out airstrikes in Nigeria, Yemen, Somalia, Syria, Iraq, threatened to take Greenland by force, twice attacked Iran. And, you know, that doesn't even take us on to the sort of increase in Israeli settler impunity. Is there not sort of, there's definitely an increase in pace of US interventions under Trump, and maybe a different in kind as well. Does that not seem right to you at all?
Yeah, I don't want to quibble about it. I'm certainly a very vehement critic of everything Donald Trump is doing when it comes to foreign policy, with the exception of his attempt, which isn't successful, but I think it's a genuine attempt to end the war in between Ukraine and Russia that is so devastating to the people of both of those countries. I think it's also worth noting that the Israelis said for 2.5 years or 2 years under President Biden, there was no attempt to pressure them into any kind of a ceasefire in Gaza. President Trump engineered a ceasefire there, not once, but twice, albeit one that the Israelis violate constantly, but it's still not the same as the full-on bombing campaign of Israel. And you mentioned Venezuela, which I think is an actual act of horrific aggression and imperialism, but it reminds me very much of what President Bush 41 did, who was very much this representative of what was supposedly this post-World War II rules-based order, when he invaded Panama and killed a lot more Panamanians than Trump did Venezuelans, abducted Manuel Noriega, much the way we just abducted Maduro, brought him back to the United States, put him on drug charges, even though he was a close U.S. ally. So again, I'm willing to acknowledge certainly threatening to take Greenland from Europe is kind of a kind and class of its own, though he hasn't done it, and I don't think he will. So I don't want to in any way appear like I'm mitigating the evils of Trump. I'm just not, I don't want to mitigate the evils of the leaders that came before him.
Sure. And if we step back a bit from immediate events in Iran, I mean, maybe we could pursue the idea in the other direction that there's a sort of discontinuity under Trump. Like if we look at things like the rhetoric of Trump that you've mentioned, and also things like the national security strategy, which seem to be suggesting like quite substantive changes in the way that US is pursuing foreign policy. Do you see any other sort of discontinuities there?
Yeah, well, so I have two examples, one that supports, I think, what you're the point that you're advancing, and one that a little bit more supports mine. So I'll give you the latter one first, which is there's a passage in the National Security Strategy that essentially says when it comes to Middle East governments in general, but particularly in the Middle East, we're no longer going to badger them or coerce them or lecture them about whether or not they offer freedom and democracy, whether or not they're monarchies, whether or not they're tyrannies. That's just not our business. All we care about is whether we can do business with them in a mutually constructive way. And that's basically Trump expressing his unvarnished love for and admiration for the tyrannies of Saudi Arabia, of Qatar, of the United Arab Emirates, of Jordan, of all essentially all those very wealthy, rich Persian Gulf dictatorships, but as well as the one in Egypt and Bahrain and Kuwait, essentially all of the US British allies that are tyrannies and have long been, even while the US and Great Britain pretend, as a lot of them are doing now, to care about combating tyranny as part of the case we're making, for example, for the war in Iran. So I appreciate that honesty, even though that's Trump saying, I want to embrace these countries, and others in the past embrace them just as much, but pretended they were pushing them toward reform. On the other hand, the complete rejuvenation of the Monroe Doctrine and these little modifications to it that Trump supporters are now calling the Donroe Doctrine, I do think that is a departure and a significant one from, say, the last 20 to 20, 25 years, where our focus was much more on the Middle East and not so much on controlling and dominating the countries of Central and Latin America. Although you only have to go back to the 1980s and Reagan's unbelievably barbaric and savage dirty wars in places like Nicaragua and El Salvador and Guatemala to see that kind of doctrine, maybe not explicitly embraced the way Trump is, but certainly enforced very robustly. So, I do think there are much more explicit affirmations of this kind of unfettered right of the United States to go use military force whenever it feels like, however it feels like. But as I said before, I think the United States has always thought it had that, or at least since the end of World War II, and just kind of was less willing to admit that that's what it was doing.
Sure. So I mean, one of the things that you talked about there was being more open to sort of be friendly with Gulf states, and not sort of pretending to only care about democracies. I mean, one way to sort of develop that is that U.S. foreign policy seems to be treating its ideological allies in Western Europe, Japan, South Korea, much more harshly now. Do you have any inkling for like what's going on there? Is it Yeah, I suppose let me just stop the question there. What is going on there with the US? Why is it doing that? And why is it pivoting to Latin America, as you say, and also to the Gulf?
Well, first of all, I think there has been a long time strain of hostility, especially on the American right, toward Western Europe in particular. The idea that Western Europeans are very kind of elitist and look down their nose at American and Americans and American culture. I think you saw a lot of that hostility and conflict manifest very strongly in the wake of the French and German resistance to the invasion of Iraq. I mean, the anti-European, anti-France, in particular, rhetoric in the United States was extremely vicious and unconstrained, and obviously didn't come out of nowhere. So I think there's been this tension, especially among American conservatives and how they perceive Western Europeans in particular, that have kind of laid the groundwork for it a long time. But I also think that in the wake of social media and the internet, and just like on the fact that we live our political and much of our civic lives online, there has emerged a pretty radical difference in approaches that government should take toward the ability, for example, of people to express themselves freely, whether or not government should be in the business of declaring and decreeing and then controlling and regulating what is and is not disinformation. I think those differences aren't just cultural. I think they're very, very real differences. And I think you add on to that the fact that I don't think Donald Trump does care all that much about democracy. I don't think when he looks around the world to the leaders he admires, he looks at Macron or certainly Keir Starmer or even Mertz or Giorgia Meloni or any of them. I think he looks toward President Xi in China, and even Kim Jong-un in North Korea. I mean, if you listen to how President, even Maduro, you know, if you listen to how President Trump's talks about these leaders, he's heaped huge amounts of praise on the former Al-Qaeda leader who's now the president of Syria, who we used to call Al-Jolani, for whom there was a, you know, $50 million reward on his head, a bounty on his head until about a year ago. You know, he talks about him with great admiration as well. He likes this kind of toughness, this like ruling by iron fist. And I think talk about, you know, NATO and EU democracy is just very unimpressive to Trump and therefore to his movement. And all of that has combined to drive a wedge between the US and Europe that wasn't previously there.
Yeah, so I mean, do you think there ever was, even before Trump, a sense in which there was a kind of shared liberal democratic ideology that united the West as a geopolitical unit, and that we're seeing that geopolitical unit kind of crumbling now?
I think there was a belief in liberal democracy for a limited part of the world, namely for the United States and for Europe, maybe for Canada, Australia, you know, the places that have a shared religious tradition, a perceived cultural tradition, even that are racially homogenized. I think you cannot exclude the racial component from it. I don't think there has been a commitment on the part of the United States and European allies to democracy in other parts of the world. That, you know, I'll just give you this very quick anecdote that illustrates the point. I think one of the very first articles when I went to work for The Guardian back in 2012 was George Galloway was a member of Parliament, David Cameron was the Prime Minister, and George Galloway stood up, maybe it was 2013, and challenged David Cameron on the British policy of arming Syrian rebels, who invariably were Al-Qaeda adjacent, if not Al-Qaeda and even ISIS, where weapons were falling into the hands of those factions. And David Cameron said, "Oh, if there's one thing I know for certain, is that when George Galloway speaks, there's going to be praise and defense coming of an Arab dictator, meaning Saddam, meaning Bashar al-Assad." And David Cameron had just returned from a multi-nation trip in the Middle East, where he sold military tech and intelligence technology to Saudi Arabia, to the Emiratis, to the Qataris, etc. And this hypocrisy has been embedded in American and European ideology for so long, this idea that we do support, not just support when we find them, but actually prop up and implant dictators and tyrannies in the parts of the world where we don't think democracy could or should thrive. But yes, I do believe there was a shared belief in democracy for our own countries. And certainly Trump, to some extent, is someone who doesn't quite believe in that as much as prior presidents did.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I'm just trying to get at the sense in which the West still exists at all as a geopolitical unit. So, I mean, one thing that's quite striking is you get this line from MAGA isolationists in particular that, you know, as you've said, they're not going to lecture other countries on what they should or shouldn't do. But at the same time, JD Vance comes to Europe to the Munich Security Conference and delivers a long lecture about how Europe should organize its affairs and so on. So, is there a sense in which Europe is still being treated differently by the US, but just in a different way to how it used to be treated differently?
Well, I think that one of the things that Trump kind of excavated that has been true for quite some time is that it has never, at least since the end of World War II, been a truly equal relationship. The dependence of Europe on the United States militarily, and even economically in terms of spending on defense, I think has created what I would call some valid resentment. I think is probably part of what led J.D. Vance to believe that he has the right to go to Europe and give those lectures, meaning your defense and your security depends on us. We're the ones you call when you need to go to war, when you're threatened. We're the ones who spend all this money on NATO that you're unwilling to spend so that you can create this safety net for your citizens that we don't give to ours. And I think there is some valid resentment there. I also think the war in Ukraine obviously has exacerbated those tensions a lot. This idea that, oh, there's this war in Europe, but it's the United States that has to spend massive amounts of money. Europe's spending obviously a huge amount of money as well. But, you know, I think a lot of people on the American right see this more as a European problem than an American one. And certainly from a geographical perspective, you can make the case that it is. But at the end of the day, I think institutionally, there's such a deep history of transatlantic ties and institutional ties, not just with NATO, but with economic institutions and so much else, that I don't think some tension and some divisive rhetoric from Trump or JD Vance is going to be enough to sever the relationship completely or irreparably. I think those ties run very, very deep, which isn't to say they're permanent. You could see over time this wedge actually happening if there's divergent interests. But yes, there's certainly more weight on it than there has been previously. But I don't think it's anywhere close to saying there's no more West or there's no more transatlantic alliance.
I mean, we've been talking a bit about the isolationist wing of MAGA, but of course, with what's going on in Iran at the moment, it seems like they're very much, they don't have Trump's ear, it seems. So I just wondered what you think going forward MAGA is going to look like. And, you know, in particular, do you think that these Iran attacks make it more likely that, you know, someone like Tucker Carlson might become the next US president? Because I'm aware that J.D. Vance is probably, he's struggling to sort of justify what's going on in Iran at the moment. Does that open it up to someone like Tucker Carlson, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, I know Tucker very well. I don't necessarily want to speak for him, except that I would say that I have always heard from him categorically and emphatically, not just in front of a camera, but off, that he has, not only does he have no desire to run, he has a desire not to for all sorts of reasons. I also think he is close to J.D. Vance, believes still in J.D. Vance's tendencies toward this non-interventionist, anti-war perspective that you clearly see Trump and his movement abandoning. I think one of the things that you're seeing, and this is, I think this is true in Europe, but I think it's even more true in a bipartisan, two-party dominant system like we have in the United States, where if you're a Republican, there's this pressure to just support whatever the Republican leader does, especially when he's in the Oval Office, and vice versa with Democrats. And so you're seeing within MAGA this strain, this kind of division, where they were told for so long that to be MAGA meant we don't go to the Middle East, we don't do regime change wars, we don't fight countries unless they're attacking us. And then you see them at the same time needing to support Trump as he bombs Yemen, as he feeds Israel money to destroy Gaza and arms to destroy Gaza, Venezuela, and now in Iran. So I think it's a question of whether Trump will retransform MAGA back into sort of a Bush-Cheney Republican, even Hillary Clinton kind of style of militarism, or whether they will search for a leader who will be more faithful to that vision, like a J.D. Vance. But in terms of personalities, I don't believe ever that Tucker will challenge or run against J.D. Vance. If J.D. Vance decided not to run for whatever reason, maybe that possibility would emerge, but I don't think so. But a Tucker-like figure kind of comes with that mentality and a credibility and among the American right, that's very possible.
Yeah. Is there anyone else that springs to mind?
I mean, I think, you know, there's people positioning themselves like Thomas Massey. Marjorie Taylor Greene certainly has, I think, become a very true believer. I believe in her sincerity. And then I think it's all a question of how J.D. Vance positions himself. I mean, he's obviously in a difficult position as vice president. He has to support Trump. He'll have no chance of getting the nomination if Trump doesn't support him. And so he can't object to what Trump's doing. But if he ties himself too closely to some disastrous policies, that might sink his future as well. So he's in a very difficult position. So I could see a kind of Marjorie Taylor Greene type figure, Thomas Massey, sort of a Rand Paul, you know, really assuming that lane and really expanding it into something quite formidable.
Sure. Okay, I'm going to open up for other people to ask questions now. So from Ricky, is the war in Iran and Venezuela really about oil to China?
I don't think you can discount when the United States initiates new wars, especially in oil-rich countries, that oil is a major factor. I definitely think Venezuela was motivated. It's very hard to say because it just kind of came out of nowhere. Trump's not exactly a cogent foreign policy thinker, a cogent thinker at all. He kind of operates by instinct, which can change from minute to minute. So it's very hard to put your finger on why these wars were approved by Trump, similar to the way people debate to this very day, like why the Iraq war? Was it about, you know, any number of things? And it probably at the end of the day isn't unicausal, but clearly the desire to keep China out of what Trump considers America's backyard, which is all of South and Central America, I think was a major cause of the what we did in Venezuela, the desire to control their oil, not to let China control it. Same with arguing that we should take back the Panama Canal. This is all part of concern about Chinese influence in the region, which is rapidly growing, but ironically growing in large part because of resentment toward American wars. So it's kind of a vicious cycle. Clearly, Iran is a geostrategically crucial country for a lot of reasons, including oil. But I would say the motive for the war in Iran was more about Israel than it was about oil, but oil is just kind of a secondary benefit, I guess, to going in and smashing the government and seeing if you can control its resources.
Sure, thank you. Will MAGA be able to spin the Iran attack as America First? So I guess that's sort of pursuing a little bit what we've been talking about.
I mean, they're definitely going to try. I mean, they're already trying. The problem is that the entire case, more or less, depends on transparent lies. And the problem for these lies is that they're so identical to what Americans lived through, principally in Iraq, for Americans who remember somewhat in Vietnam, but even in Libya and Afghanistan. You know, just very quickly, I was before we started our event, about 10 minutes before, I wrapped up a show with Piers Morgan that I did, and it was about Iran. And the first guest was former Vice President Mike Pence, who was Trump's vice president under his first administration, who made the case for war in Iran. And it was unbelievable listening to it because Mike Pence was somebody who voted for the war in Iraq, defended the war in Iraq for years, defends it to this very day. And the case he made for why we had to go to war with Iran is exactly the same as for the war in Iraq. And so I think there's something in the body politic, because it's not just Democrats, but mostly Trump, who has told them this kind of thinking is destructive. You should reject the idea that we have to be in all these wars in the Middle East. He's almost dug his own grave in a sense, because he's so much laid the foundation, even among his own voters, to have to find these arguments that they now have to make repellent. And I think people understand that Iran is not a threat to the United States. People don't wake up concerned or worried about the Ayatollah or the mullahs. Similar to why the Democrats had a very hard time convincing Americans to be afraid of Putin and Russia. Maybe in Europe you can make that case, but Americans just didn't believe that Putin was a threat to them. And I think that obviously they're going to try and make that case, but it's almost impossible because it's so such the antithesis of America First, to the point where you can find Trump and JD Vance and all the way down the line explicitly saying that wars exactly like this, or even this exact war with Iran, are so destructive to American interests.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that some people might say is that, a population, the US population, hates war when it goes on forever, but it doesn't necessarily hate kind of very dramatic, apparently successful strikes like we saw in Venezuela, like I guess Trump is going for with Iran. So is there anything in the idea that Trump has ended forever wars and he's pursuing a different kind of warfare, I suppose?
Yeah, I think it's an important point. We talked about Yemen. Joe Biden bombed Yemen all throughout 2024. Trump criticized him for it. Trump gets into office, resumes and escalates that bombing campaign. But after about a month, Trump began seeing that a lot of what he was promised would happen against the Houthis to degrade their capabilities wasn't happening. We were depleting our stockpiles. We had ordered it stopped after a month, even though none of the goals was fulfilled, because he was worried about getting dragged into a, as you called it, forever war. Same with Venezuela. When we got Maduro, a lot of people had the expectation, oh, we're going to now change the regime, and Maria Machado or whomever these opposition figures in Venezuela would be implanted as the leader. And Trump left the entire government in place, I think, because he wanted to avoid that quagmire. The question with Iran, though, is there's been so much rhetoric about how we're going to free the Iranians. This is an evil regime that murdered its own citizens. Trump already committed to kind of 4 weeks of bombing. It's very easy to imagine how this could spiral out of control, with Iran is serious about retaliating. They're retaliating in many different places. Nobody can predict with any degree of precision, let alone even kind of a reasonable comfort zone, that this won't spiral out of control. So it's a very dangerous game Trump is playing. And at the end of the day, he needs a credible way to declare victory. And if that regime is still in place, just without Khomeini, it's very hard to make the case like he like no one really cared about Venezuela. I think the big thing is troops on the ground, which Trump hasn't done, but also American troops returning home in caskets and body bags. And that's why the death of these four American soldiers in the first day of the war was so consequential, because you're right, Americans care about the duration of the war, not wanting to see troops deployed on the ground, but they really care about Americans dying. They didn't see that in Yemen. They didn't see that in Venezuela. But now we already are seeing that in Iran.
Right. Yeah. Okay. It would be great to chat for longer about this, but I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. So thank you, everyone, for joining us. Bye bye.